Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
What's up, Internet, and welcome back to the Engadget Podcast. I'm senior editor Devinder Hardwar. Joining me today is our podcast producer, Ben Elman. Hey, Ben.
Hello.
Sherlyn is off because she's traveling for the holidays, and honestly, most of the people in Engadget are off. We're just taking it easy right now, except there's like one big story that's been bubbling up, and that's the whole Apple Watch patent mess that is happening. And basically, Apple has paused sales of the Apple Watch Series 9 and Ultra 2. We'll be diving into everything happening around that with a special guest. And Ben, are you ready for the holidays? Are you prepped?
I didn't think that I was going to be the sort of person who is staggering to the holiday, like just pulling myself by my fingertips. But God, does it seem like it finds me every year.
Every time. Well, it's more like you have to get ready to stop working for a while and work piles up. I am wearing the Windows ugly sweater, the latest one. So it is clouds. It's the Windows 95 desktop image. I like that Microsoft puts these things out, and nobody around me understands what this sweater is. So
I think you of all people could understand that ugly sweaters were supposed to be like an anti-capitalist thing where like go to a thrift store and get an old ugly sweater. Yep. Now, like, the ugly sweater industrial complex just makes more stuff. We can leave that for somewhere else.
Everything has to be commodified. Everything has to be resold to us. So anyway, folks, if you're enjoying the podcast, please be sure to subscribe to us on iTunes or your podcaster of choice. Leave us a review on iTunes. Drop us an email at podcast@engadget.com. We will probably have next week off. It depends. We're getting ready for CES. I'm going to be off next week, but we'll see. If Sherlyn finds a good topic, we may have an episode next week. So stay tuned for all of that. Let's move on to what's going on with the Apple Watch. So joining us is Christina Farr, a health tech investor at Omer's Ventures, author of Second Opinion, the newsletter. Hey, Chrissy, how's it going?
Hello. It's so nice to be here. Happy holidays.
Yeah, happy holidays. Happy to have you back too. For background, folks, Chrissy and I used to work together at VentureBeat, and now Chrissy is a recovering journalist and moving on to covering, doing health tech investment stuff. So how are you doing, Chrissy, just in general these days?
I'm good. I have to say it's a little bit refreshing to not have to be the person jumping on the news at random hours in the night when something like this happens with the Apple Watch. But I have fond memories. That was certainly something you and I used to do together, and you know, when we were back at VentureBeat back in the day. But yeah, I mean, it's been interesting watching this whole saga unfold. And I gotta say, it's been like over a decade for me just kind of following the story. So we'll definitely get into it. Lots to talk about.
It's been, you know, let me just also say, like, our listeners may remember the when the Samsung, what was it, the Galaxy, this is the first like Samsung smartwatch. Chrissy, you broke that story. I remember you calling me while I was shopping for furniture, and just like we were workshopping some ideas around that. So that story went to Good Morning America. You were kind of at the forefront of smartwatches hitting America, right? Was it the Galaxy
Fit? Yeah,
it's
crazy to think about that.
I forget what they called it.
But yeah, I think I did leak the first Samsung smartwatch, like all the original designs for it. And that, gosh, that must have been 2013 or something like that. So this was, you know, this was early. And since then, obviously, we've had so many others come to the forefront with Fitbit and Apple Watch, certainly. And we've made massive strides with the technology and consumer adoption. But yeah, I mean, seriously, OG. We're like OG tech reporters. Making me feel old.
So in October, the International Trade Commission, the ITC, said that Apple was infringing on Masimo's patents around blood oxygen sensors around its pulse oximeter. And this has been an ongoing thing. Chrissy, you've probably been hearing about this like ongoing battle between Apple and Masimo forever, right? Because this kind of goes back years. This goes back a long while. This feature first launched on the Apple Watch 6. So that was like 2020. But Apple has been working on this, and I think the story is way back in 2013. I'm reading a recap here from 9 to 5 Mac. Apple reportedly contacted medical tech company Masimo about forming a working relationship around their pulse oximeter. That never actually happened. But the story is Apple saw, you know, confidential information. They signed the NDAs. They hired Masimo's chief medical officer at the beginning of 2013. And the story is that Masimo has filed a lawsuit in 2020 accusing Apple of stealing trade secrets because of hiring him. Their technology seems very similar to Masimo's own pulse oximeter. Chrissy, like, do you have any thoughts just from the overall tech, the health tech industry about this situation?
Yeah, so this is like, this goes way back for me. I started reporting on this in 2014 when I had joined Reuters and I was the Apple reporter there. And I had started to notice, because I was really close with a lot of people in the biomedical and healthcare world, because that was my other passion, as you know, that Apple was hiring people out of companies like Masimo. And that was surprising because at the time, it didn't really make any sense. Like they had sort of hinted that there was going to be some kind of healthcare strategy, but there was really, I mean, we were still calling it the iWatch. You remember that? Mm-hmm. Like yeah. It was still really unclear what they were going to do. And I put out this story in, here it is. It's for Reuters. May 5th, 2014, Apple on medical tech hiring spree, a possible hint of iWatch plans. And it included a few quotes from Joe Kiani, who is the Masimo CEO, who I had just gotten to know around that time. And he had said, mm-hmm. look, Apple's hiring a lot of my really good people. I mean, this is the quote. Some of the talent Apple recruited has access to deep wells of trade secrets and information. And among those hired was actually the chief medical officer for Masimo, as well as over 20 engineers. It's now come out that it was that number. Mm-hmm. So, you know, he told me they're just buying people. And I just hope that Apple is not doing what we're doing. And, you know, this was before we even saw any of the original kind of designs for the watch. And ultimately, as you mentioned, there was a strong kind of indicator in that initial watch that they were going to be doing something in blood oxygen. And the pulse oximetry space at the time was really dominated by this company, Masimo. Mm-hmm. So this was a really big threat. And the CEO was worried about it even a decade ago. And it's certainly the case that Apple has pursued the strategy. And, you know, obviously it's a matter of the courts and the lawyers to determine whether or not this is, you know, just Apple coming up with its own spin on this technology. And as many people have pointed out, big companies will borrow ideas from each other all the time. It just happens. Or this is something that, you know, one would say is just infringement, that they just directly copied from this company, Masimo. And I think, you know, there's just been a lot of debate about it. And it's obviously looking more favorable now to Masimo, but I think Apple's hoping that the Biden administration will ultimately side with them and see their view. And they, you know, that they'll know that Apple is this very innovative company, and it's just not in their nature to steal from other companies. So both sides of this have come out pretty strongly on this issue, and I think only time will tell where it's going to go and how it's going to land.
Yeah, a couple of things I want to lay out here, too. Because of that October ITC decision, Apple basically has been told that it has to stop selling the Apple Watch Series 9 and Ultra 2 on December 21st. That's the day we're recording this, on their website, and on December 24th at Apple's retail store. So timing not so great for people looking for last-minute gifts. To be clear, to third-party retailers like Amazon and Best Buy can still keep selling these things, but they will not get new stock. This is basically a shipment ban and also a ban from Apple, you know, selling its own stuff. The latest news we have this morning, we have a story from Richard Lai in Hong Kong. The ITC has denied Apple's request to pause the ban. They were saying, like, Apple's, like, in process of getting the appeal done, but that's going to take a little while. Apple had asked to just, like, pause the ban so sales could keep happening. That's been denied. So the only thing left now is President Biden could veto this decision to keep the sales going. And we're just kind of waiting to see if that happens. Historically, that's not a thing that tends to happen pretty often. So yeah, this is just a really strange case of Apple's most high-profile wearables now just cannot be sold in the U.S. because of this dispute. Chrissy, like you were mentioning, you were hearing that Apple is doing the same thing from other companies. Is this kind of a habit from Apple of like poaching people to help build tech that they're seeing, you know, being built elsewhere?
Yeah, it's a great set of questions you bring up. Interestingly, I did see Gene Munster, who was this sort of Apple analyst that everybody talks to, and also an investor, say that he does not think that this will make a huge dent on Apple Watch sales, because most people who would buy a watch for Christmas have already done so. So yeah. So probably not huge consequences for Apple in terms of it just, you know, making a dent on sales. But then certainly the symbolism around this is massive. And Joe Kiani has been the CEO of Massimo, has just been on television recently on a spree just saying this company stole from us and is not as innovative as it used to be. And this is not the Apple that you know from the era of Steve Jobs. And certainly you've seen both sides of it really come out. You know, a lot of people have said actually Apple is still the most innovative business in the US, and that, you know, just because they both have this interest in developing blood oxygen sensors doesn't mean that Apple didn't do it in its own way. And there have been other issues that have come up in the past with its health technology push. A business called AliveCor at one point also had a dispute with Apple over the ECG feature that was designed around heart health. So you've seen this come up before with some of these smaller companies that develop kind of aspects of what the watch is doing overall in health. And I think it's going to continue, as Apple will certainly move into other areas of health monitoring with the watch. There have been reports, including from myself, about their interest in areas ranging from kind of blood glucose to, you know, really doing more in the sort of stress area and monitoring stress and anxiety and so many other things that they intend to do with the watch. But there are, of course, other companies that are also developing technologies in these spaces. And Apple does tend to poach a lot of talent from these companies. A lot of the reason for that, Devendra, is really around this question of build or buy. And they do not buy. They do not buy very often. And when they do buy, it tends to be, especially in healthcare, really small acquisitions, $5, $10, $20 million acquisitions of companies that you've never heard of. And then some reporter will have to find out that this acquisition even happened months later, or sometimes it never really comes out at all. But those are the tens of acquisitions that it does, not the multi-billion dollar public company acquisitions, because those are the sorts of things where you get, you know, much more involvement from regulators. It becomes a huge press story. It indicates what their future plans will be. And so I think that's one of the reasons why they didn't buy Massimo, although now it's been reported that there were talks at one point in time. Whether or not that's true, I have not confirmed independently, but those talks have been rumored. So yeah, I mean, there's just a lot of interesting things here to unpack. But yeah, they do tend to pursue a strategy of build rather than buy, which is, I think, what we're seeing in this case.
Yeah, I think the tough thing for Apple here is that they have both the means and the motive, basically, to use Massimo's ideas for their own pulse oximeter tech. I'm sure they're aware of the potential downsides of doing this, but there are reports like the 9to5 Mac report. The Wall Street Journal had reported that they ended up paying Dr. Michael O'Reilly, the former chief medical officer at Massimo, millions of dollars to come over. And that guy has in his brain a lot of proprietary technology and ideas. Apple ended up filing its own patents around pulse oximeters, but it is trying to invalidate Massimo's. And I think that is where this whole discussion is kind of like, this is where it's all kind of focused. And Apple tends to do that, right? They tend to patent their own stuff and maybe deny or, I don't know, diminish the patents from other companies, even though they're using very similar stuff. Ben, did you have any thoughts on that?
So Chrissy, I'm not sure how much you know about the legal details of this, but if you poach, like we just said, Apple hired a Massimo executive, a medical director who knows just a lot of things, and it's all inside his head. how are you supposed to completely make sure that, like, you're not accidentally doing patent infringement?
Yeah, I mean, I think that is definitely a question for the lawyers, but you could argue, there's so many ways to argue this. You could say you can't, you know, this guy has got a deep well of knowledge and it's really hard to totally separate that. On the other hand, whether you're, you know, in the world of biomedical sensing, it is a very, very small world, very small. So there are not that many people that you can even hire that can build, you know, these sorts of sensors in areas like pulse oximetry, in areas like non-invasively detecting glucose, which, by the way, nobody's managed to do. And companies ranging from Google to J&J to Apple, I mean, countless companies have spent billions on trying to do this and have failed because it is so hard. You just need some of the best talent in the world, and you need so much money because it's a physics problem, it's a chemistry problem. Even just separating glucose and water in the blood is a near impossible task. And this is true across so many of these kind of attempts to build new things, you know, with something as small as the form factor of the watch. From a biomedical perspective, it just boggles the mind in terms of how complicated it is. So that's a very long-winded way of saying very small pool to hire from.
Yeah, and if you're a patent lawyer, please email us at podcast@engadget.com. I'd really like to know, if there are only a few different ways to skin the proverbial cat here, how do you not end up doing patent infringement? Because, you know, there might only be three ways of doing it.
It's tough. You know, we talked about Apple's ambition stretching way back basically over a decade into doing things like non-invasive glucose monitoring. Chrissy, you probably ended up reporting on some of this, but we talked about the revelation that Apple had basically spun out like a secret startup to work on this stuff and to work on tech for the Apple Watch. And glucose monitoring was something they wanted in the initial launch and they couldn't make it happen. That kind of like shifted Apple Watch from being like a great medical device towards being more of like an activity tracking and a fun device. It's a little different there. You know, what do you think this whole thing means for Apple's health ambitions? Because it seems like this is a company that wants to do more in health, and they have the money. Like, they have more money than most other companies on hand to just like barrel their way into this. What do you think this means for Apple's, medical plans or health plans in general?
So I actually broke a lot of that news about that secret division when I was at CNBC. And I will say that my sources made really clear at the time that Apple never intended for glucose to be part of the original watch. Because of the reasons that I mentioned, it is really, really hard. I don't even know how to stress that. Like, it's possible that we may never be able to accomplish this in our lifetimes.
It seems like a Theranos-level goal of just like, having a magical, thing happening with health that's never been possible before. Yeah,
exactly. It's there's a book written about this called The Hunt for the Deceitful Turkey that is brilliant if you're very interested in this stuff, worth reading. But yes, they had, this goes back all the way to Steve Jobs when he got pancreatic cancer. He ended up getting diabetes because they took out a piece of his pancreas and literally on his deathbed bought a company in this space, in the biomedical sensing space. So I think, you know, from what I had heard, after he passed, Apple kind of ended up with this division of like, oh crap, we have this and we don't, I guess we have to like make good on this. So that led to this kind of secretive company that has been now reported on and I think is widely known, despite that Apple has never really confirmed its existence. Mm-hmm. So clearly they would like to be able to kind of move into some of these areas. It makes so much sense. I mean, I've always said, and I still maintain, the Apple Watch from a medical perspective is a nice to have. Being able to non-invasively monitor blood glucose on this device for the first time is a must-have. And it's not just millions of people worldwide who have diabetes, type 1 and type 2. It's for every single person on the planet. And it's not just blood glucose. I think blood oxygen is another really, really huge and important unlock for cardiovascular health. It's an absolute game changer. So I think if that happens, you know, and who knows what form it may take, maybe it is going to be an exact replacement for some of these medical devices that are on the market that are minimally invasive, or it will be a trend line or something else. But if Apple is able to pull it off, it will be the great contribution to mankind that they claimed that healthcare would be five, 6 years ago. I think it was Tim Cook who said that.
I don't believe
that Apple has made a great contribution to mankind yet. But if they can pull this off, like, I will be the first one, like, acknowledging that, because that is going to be a very big deal.
Absolutely. I have family members who suffer from diabetes. It is something I'm worried about myself, too. Like, it is, yeah, this would be saving thousands of lives, potentially millions, I guess, every year by having access to that tech. So, you know, we'll be keeping a close eye on all of this, of course. Chrissy Farr, thank you so much for joining us. Where can people find your work online these days and just your thoughts?
Yeah, follow me on Twitter. I guess I'm supposed to call it X, at Chrissy.
We never do it. It's fine.
Okay, Twitter. Okay, and that's what it should be. Yeah, so who knows if that'll be around in a year from now, but please follow me on Twitter. I'm still there, and I have a Substack too called Second Opinion. And I just mostly use it to write about healthcare. So would love to see you there.
Thank you. Let's move on to some other news and some, I guess, genuinely sad news. A Bloomberg report has found a large AI data set, Lion 5B, has over 1,000 child abuse images within it. It can also be used to create material that basically demonstrate child sexual abuse, or CSAM material. This is gross. This is gross as hell, and exactly the thing I worry about when we are building these AI models, where it's just like collecting information we don't know. It's kind of like a black box is what's in there. But when you look too deeply, it is not great stuff. This is a great report by Davey Alba and Rachel Metz, both great reporters. And let me just see here. It's generally not great news. And this is also not a new thing, right, Ben? You saw something else that had like a similar issue.
How do you get 1,000 CSAM images in an AI model to begin with?
People have CSAM images and they are just around. It's gross as hell.
So what you're doing is you're just like tying together huge tranche of images and eventually things just filter in. Like, mm-hmm. Yeah, that's very bizarre. But the connection that I wanted to mention was a 404 Media report about a platform called Civit AI. This is a venture-backed platform. Andreessen Horowitz put a bunch of money into it, of course, with their new push into AI. According to a 404 Media report, at least 60% of the images on Civit AI could be considered as NSFW. They could be considered deepfake. There are some models on Civit AI that could generate CSAM materials on their own.
It is shocking just how much CSAM material is out there, and it's absolutely disgusting. And this to me is like one of those red flags about AI too, of how we're just building these models. And I don't know how this AI model got racist. I don't know how this AI model has all these, like, you know, all these beliefs, even though it's pulled from information that is not great.
That's why AI ethics is so important, because you need to think about what you're putting into the machines. Mm-hmm. I think I've talked about it on the show before. In 2018, there was a really good book published called Automating Inequality by Virginia Eubanks. And in broad strokes, the idea of this book is, if you give the machines just all of the data rather than specific data for the outcomes you want, if you give the machine all of the mortgage data going back, you know, 70 years or something, it will eventually realize, oh, redlining might be good, actually. There's a whole lot of data in here that says redlining is good. I'm just going to continue doing that.
The most efficient way to raise retail, you know, real estate prices in specific zones, like, yeah.
Or the best way to get people out of hospitals, according to IBM's Watson, is to just discharge them. Not to find the most efficient treatment methods, but just why not discharge them?
In Georgia, we are having the issue of not enough hospitals. It's disgusting. Like, they are shutting down and people are just having to travel many, many miles to get any medical help. Anyway, this is all very sad, but this is why we are worried about us leaning so much on AI, folks. I'm working on a piece, actually. It should be up by the time this article or this podcast goes up. But I've worked on a piece about what Microsoft is doing with AI and Windows and why I'm still not fully sold on it, and why I think, you know, Microsoft, there are potential issues around all this AI stuff that we need to see. So anyway, let's move on to a slightly less sad story. Sony has said, Sony announced yesterday that it has officially sold 50 million PlayStation 5s. So basically 3 years since its launch in November 2020. Notably, that is only 1 week longer than it took the PlayStation 4 to reach that number. So the PS5 has been plagued by production issues, you know, all sorts of delays, all the pandemic, like supply chain issues, but they still managed to hit this number. Yeah, it just looks like this is basically on track to be, once again, the winner of this generation, similar to what happened with the last gen. We saw one source saying PlayStation 4 sales, lifetime sales, were 117.2 million. Xbox One was 58.5 million, almost half.
Well, yeah, but Xbox and Microsoft don't release information as often as
they don't. It's all
Sony
estimates.
Does.
Yeah. It's all estimates, but it is very, very sad. I was looking at a piece from the Financial Times, which pulled data from Ampere Analysis, and we have to look at data analysis because Microsoft does not release information about this stuff. Ampere estimated that Microsoft sold 7.6 million Xbox Series X and S systems this year. That's a 15% drop from last year. But Sony sales exploded by 65%. To reach 22.5 million units. And I mean, listen, we've been talking about these consoles and the issues Microsoft has been facing for a while. It is no surprise why this is happening. Like, Sony's got the games. Sony has the games people want to play. Spider-Man 2 just came out. And it seems like every time Microsoft tries to bank on a big-ass release, they just fall on their face. Like, whatever their plans are, like Halo Infinite was going to be a big deal, had to be delayed a year. And when it launched, it was just fine. I actually really like the multiplayer, but was not enough to like really get people to buy that hardware. Redfall was another one. I was super excited about it from Arkane. Disaster of a game, apparently. It just like was rushed and barely a game in there. I guess the argument has been, like, I don't know if you've noticed this, but I wonder if Microsoft just doesn't even really care about these hardware numbers as much, because what they want to do is sell Game Pass subscriptions, and they can do that to PC users and everything too. Like, that is Microsoft's gaming ambition. But I do think it would help them to sell more units too, to be honest.
Have you heard anyone talking about Starfield in the last month or so?
In terms of how disappointed they are, yes. But that's the only... Yeah, Starfield is another one, by the way. Starfield was the game we were waiting all year for, and it's Microsoft spent so much money buying Bethesda and all these other developers, and we got another Bethesda game that is kind of disappointing and honestly not as good as some of their older games. So,
and
sad state of affairs.
It is a sad state of affairs. I try not to let nostalgia color my understanding of what console generation was the best, but man, does it seem like Microsoft hasn't had heat like it did during the original Halo trilogy.
Well, depends on what you mean by original, but Xbox...
What I'm talking about, yeah, is Halo Combat Evolved, Halo 2, Halo 3... Between the Xbox and the 360 seemed like the time when it was on the most equal footing, at least to me, the like totally uncultured observer at that point. If we go back and look at the numbers, I think the PS2 still like dramatically outsold.
No, absolutely. No, dude, the first Xbox was a disaster for Microsoft. Like, Microsoft basically came into this being like, we got a ton of money. We have the most powerful system on the market. And they did. It had the most power. It was a freaking brick. Was widely rejected in Japan. Like, the Japanese market never accepted it. And Xbox is still having trouble there. Worldwide was having issues. It really was just Halo and some of the sports games, I think, that just really sold it on people. What is funny, and maybe at some point we can have this discussion, is that I was a huge Dreamcast fan. The Dreamcast was the first console.
We talked every time we talk about consoles, you want to talk about Dreamcast.
But the Dreamcast was basically the Xbox 0.5, because the Dreamcast ran Windows CE, which also powered the Xbox, and I think certainly gave Microsoft a lot of a preview of what it took to get into this market. And the Dreamcast was also killed because of Windows CE, and Windows CE had bad copy protection, and everybody was copying discs, and it was a wild time to be on the internet. It's a good old time.
Some men think about the Roman Empire. Devendra thinks about the Dreamcast.
I think about the Dreamcast all the time. But the Xbox 360 was the main, well, like, was when the Xbox really took off. Microsoft Benefit, I believe it came out a little earlier than the PlayStation 3. It was cheaper than the PlayStation 3. They had some really good games. And then Microsoft lost a ton of money because of the whole Red Ring of Death problem. So that was, again, even though the 360 was a huge success, they had to replace basically every single console. So they lost billions on that, too.
I had to send my 360 in for Red Ring of Death.
I did, too. I actually paid to get mine fixed because I had bought a used one. And the person who sold it clearly had, like, removed the backplate to, like, to a different serial number. I was like, dude, what's going on here? So I basically had to spend, like, $150 or whatever to get the motherboard replaced. And after that deal, after Microsoft announced it would be fixing everything, they just sent out checks to everybody who paid to get it fixed. So imagine the amount of money it took. Anyway, Microsoft has been pouring money into video games for a while, and it really only worked out during the 360, and even then just barely because of that whole replacement thing. And then they screwed up the Xbox One generation because they got too big for their britches and was like, this is your only box. This is your entertainment box. And I don't know. This company is just never going to catch up to anything on the gaming
Okay, front. So let's talk about Bird.
Let's talk about Bird.
And I'm not talking about the ones that fly. I'm talking about the ones that clog your sidewalks in every urban area.
The ones that crashed, basically. And, the electric scooter company Bird announced this week that it's filing for bankruptcy 2 years after going public. This does not mean Bird is going away immediately. Let me see here. Existing lenders have agreed to purchase the assets, and the company is being kept afloat via a $25 million loan from Apollo Global Management, which, by the way, owns Engadget and Yahoo and yeah. Second lien holders, and they basically are keeping Bird running. It's going to keep operating as usual. This is not affecting Bird Canada or Bird Europe, which is those are separate companies. But
okay.
The company is just saying, like, hey, we expanded too quickly. We moved too fast, and they just could not keep up. What do you think of the Bird scooters, Ben? Like, have you used any of these things? Because there's a ton of options in New York now.
They don't have just scooters littering the streets. I'm not sure if they ever
They never did in New York.
They
New
had
York was,
revels.
Like, wise to be like, no. We're not letting you do this garbage here. So
they had revels.
They had revels.
Those were
Revel fell apart, too, by the way. Yeah.
Yes, those, but Revel was a like street legal scooter, like moped company. And I know of at least one person who died.
Oh, no.
On a Revel. Not me personally, but there was a local, like, New York City TV news reporter, a young woman.
I remember
just
that.
Starting her on camera career for, I think, ABC, nightly news. And so they spent a lot of time looking into Revel specifically because of that. Like, she was just trying to have fun on a weekend. And
mopeds are dangerous. And New York is not so Revel shut down its moped business on November 18th. They announced that's going away. They still are running an electric car rental business. You can, like, pick those up and drive them all around the city. But New York is notoriously dangerous for bikes. And mopeds, too, which move even faster than bikes. And I think cars have even less time to, like, deal with it. At least they were bright blue. And that was a safe version of this whole thing, right? I think the Bird thing, when I used to visit Austin or visit the West Coast for events and stuff, I was shocked at how just, like, the streets were just littered with garbage scooters. Usually Bird, sometimes other companies.
My first exposure was in Washington, D.C. in, like, 2017, 2018. That was the first time that I had interacted with that generation of, like, electric push scooters. And it was so much fun.
Yeah.
But I could definitely see how you just hit a crack in the sidewalk and all of a sudden you bought your orthopedic surgeon a whole new round of Christmas gifts.
Sure. Assuming it's your orthopedic surgeon, assuming it's not, like, your brain leaking out onto the sidewalk or something, because most people you're not renting these things and wearing a helmet. But I do remember being shocked at these companies who could just, like, deploy these things in cities and not give a shit about where things are stored, right, or where things have to be parked. And people, tragedy the common stuff, will just, like, leave the thing anywhere because there's nothing telling them not to, and they're not going to get a ticket for leaving it in the middle of the street or whatever. Or in the sidewalk. It's garbage.
Isn't that the whole idea of, like, better to ask for forgiveness than permission? And they figured that people would just love it so much that eventually they would build in laws after the fact.
I think it was more like,
would allow for these scooters. It's
also win at all costs. This is like post Uber, where Uber just took over, like basically obliterated rivals, cheated to take a lot of business away from Lyft. We've talked about this.
I'm watching Super Pumped right now. Yeah. I like Joseph Gordon-Levitt. So
he's fine, but do not watch his latest movie on Apple TV because he is terrible in it and it really kind of kills that movie. Anyway, Bird filing for bankruptcy just feels like just desserts for this company. So yeah, we'll be seeing whatever else happens. I kind of want to punch every VC who was hyping up micromobility just because it was a really good investment opportunity for them because they wanted to see what happened to Uber happen to these companies as well. And it's all just such garbage. And we could clock that from the beginning when you see these things littering the streets with basically no repercussions. In other big news this week, hackers have released footage from the upcoming Wolverine game and 1.3 other million stolen files from Insomniac Games. This is part of a ransomware attack. They demanded a $2 million ransom. Insomniac did not pay up, so stuff got leaked out. The group is Ryseda. They announced that they had taken 1.67 terabytes of data, including a lot of like personal information from company employees too. So like, I believe sensitive numbers, I think photos of passports that they had for some reason. I don't know why a company would have that on file, but okay.
I think that might be like more HR documents than anything.
Those are more HR documents, yes, but you don't take those scans. Like, or at least those would be within Concur or like a secure system that's holding that data. So yeah, I don't know.
That might reveal that they might not have an instance of Concur.
This is Sony. Anyway.
I don't know. I just thought it was really interesting that the hacker group that did it in their statement said, oh, it took only 20 to 25 minutes, like easy peasy, like GG, no re, like such a hacker way such of being like, thing. Oh yeah, it was so easy. Like just did it in an afternoon, basically.
Mm-hmm. I'm reading from our Engadget report. Ryseda's initial notice allowed anyone to bid on the data, not just Insomniac Games, and some of it was bought. We don't know by who, but when they dumped this data, they only dumped 98% of the stolen data. So that's 2% of data in God knows whose hands at this point. And they could be doing anything with it. So yeah, not great for Insomniac Games. There's a lot of discourse too about how other websites are covering the information coming out of these leaks and, you know, how bad it feels for the game industry. And I think this is a good reminder to people that, the games media and the games industry and developers are not the same thing. We are separate forces, and some sites will cover things deeply when they get access to any information. Some will take their time. Some will be more judicious. We didn't really dive into too many of the leaks ourselves, but I don't blame any site that does because the information is out there. You know, so that's the thing. And I'm looking forward to this game. I love Insomniac. I love Wolverine. I love Wolverine more than Spider-Man. I cannot wait.
Games reporters aren't here to protect your idea of the games industry. Just remember that.
That's basically it. And there's a weird thing happening in media and in professional circles in general, where it's like PR and the media and PR and other folks are like mixing and thinking they're all friends. And like, yeah, I'm very friendly with PR people, but I cannot be very good friends with too many folks because sometimes I have to report in your company doing bad things and you're going to feel bad about it. That's it. Let's move on to what we're working on. And just me this week, I guess. I am, just fully preparing for CS. We have so many embargoes. We have so much details. I think this is going to be a really fun event. We're going to do a CS preview when I get back. That'll be the first week of January. And that should be fun because I think there's a lot of stuff that people are going to be looking forward to. I also have that piece I mentioned about Microsoft's AI ambitions. I spent a lot of time like just racking my brain about that and what's happening. Check out that piece. There are some quotes from Aaron Woodman, who is the chief, the head of marketing for Windows. I talked to him back in September and had nowhere to like use that interview before. So there is some information there that I think is pretty cool. Let's move on to our pop culture picks for the week. And I have a couple things because I feel like the common theme lately has been about the world ending and just civilization falling apart. So,
I mean, that's one of your favorite topics.
It is.
Let's be real.
But also, buddy, it's happening. Like we're seeing the seeds of our destruction being planted all around us. I want to shout out Carol in the End of the World, which is a new show on Netflix. It's an animated show by Dan Gutterman, who I believe used to work on Rick and Morty. He was also the head writer of The Onion for like a decade in the 2000s. So he is somebody who is, I think, a deeply funny dude. This is a show set in a world where everyone knows the world is going to end. Like, for certain, there is a planet in the sky. It is slowly coming closer to Earth. Scientists are just like, we're doomed. That's it. So it is a really interesting exploration of how society would react to that, of people just like living their best lives. And, you know, capitalism breaks, basically, because everything seems like it's free. And the show is about somebody who does not know how to survive in this environment. It's about Carol, who's a very normcore lady. All she wants to do is go to Applebee's. She misses the state of the world. She does not want to live her best self because she that's just not what she wants. It's a show about her self.
What if your best self is boring?
What if your best self is super, super boring? And Carol's very boring. But what is interesting about the show is that we see a lot of people doing all the things, like traveling all around the world, you know, going on adventures. And then we see Carol, who's just like, this all just seems really boring. I just want to live my boring life. And I miss that. And I think it's kind of sweet. It's kind of life affirming. You do kind of root for Carol, even though she's infuriating as a character sometimes. It's just like, live a little lady. Come on. And I won't spoil like what ends up happening. But this show ends up being a bit like Office Space and Severance in ways I did not expect. It's a slow burn at times. It's not always immediately funny. I think the best way to describe it is that it's the anti Rick and Morty, where Rick and Morty is a mile a minute joke show. With really colorful, flamboyant characters. This is a show that takes its sweet time because it's really about civilization coming to terms with impending doom. And it's kind of fascinating. It reminds me of Lars von Trier's Melancholia, except a little funnier. I think that's worth watching, especially if you want like a slow burn kind of comedy. I also want to shout out Leave It All Behind, the new Sam Esmail movie that's on Netflix, mainly because I love Sam Esmail, the creator, writer, director of Mr. Robot. This is his second feature film. He did a rom-com that was not so great, and we don't talk about it. But this is a really cool you know, exploration of like what a small group of people would be doing if a civilization was slowly like, I don't know if it was an attack or something that slowly like broke civilization and you end up being stuck with your family and just trying to keep them safe. I think it's a lot of fun, even though I know people are very mad about the ending. If you want something that does end perfectly, I do want to shout out A Murder at the End of the World, which is on Hulu, which is also kind of like Mr. Robot. I talked about it before. It is Mr. Robot meets a girl with a dragon tattoo. It's very, very good. And I can tell you for a certain, it is a limited series that ends well. It is good all the way through. I think it gets even better since the beginning. It's also a murder mystery. And I think the actual solution to the mystery is also really cool and kind of relevant to things we've been talking about. So if you're listening to this podcast, you will probably like A Murder at the End of the World. It's on Hulu right now. And what do you got, Ben?
In 2021, there was a really great headline published in the science section of the New York Times. Mm-hmm. It was, "When an eel climbs a ramp
yes.
to eat squid from a clamp. That's amore."
Yes.
It was written by a young science writer named Sabrina Imbler. And I can't with full confidence say that this headline got them a book deal. But I can tell you that their book, How Far the Light Reaches, is currently sitting on my nightstand. And it is a lot of fun to read. It is ocean facts, ichthyology facts, marine biology, intertwined with memoir. And so if that's something that you're interested in, there's a lot of coming of age. There's a lot of talking about queerness and stuff. But if you're not here for the stories about coming of age in, you know, the 2010s, you could always be enthralled by the accounts of the entire, like, ecological systems that form around whale falls. When a whale dies, it might feed the ocean floor for more than 100 years. It's amazing.
Yeah, imagine that giant thing just slowly sinking to the bottom of the ocean. Yeah.
Because usually the things that live on the bottom of the ocean eat this stuff called marine snow. It's like, imagine like something that lived on the floor of your house ate just like the dust and like
and the
little
skin flakes.
Particles.
Yeah.
Yeah, basically. Like that's this whole ecosystem on the ocean floor, except for when a whale dies and sinks, and then, man, there's just like a jubilee, an explosion. So if you want to learn some cool marine biology facts, Effects. Check out How Far the Light Reaches by Sabrina Imbler.
Thank you, Ben. I need to have more time to read books, just to carve that out in my life.
Yeah, that's something that I'm trying to do more in the coming year.
Please do. Please do. Like, life may take you another direction, so take your free time while you have it and read some books, everybody, because now I regret not reading enough. Thank you so much. That's a wrap for this episode. Our theme music is by game composer Dale North. Our outro music is by our very own managing editor, Terrence O'Brien. The podcast is produced by Mr. Ben Elman. You can find me online at Devendra on Mastodon and Blue Sky. And, you know, I'm on Threads, but don't get me on both Threads. Like, Threads is getting really thirsty of just telling me, hey, your friends are talking on Threads. Come to Threads. No, thank you, Threads. Where can we find you online, Ben?
Send me an email at benelman.wav@gmail.com. That's it.
That's it. Just one dot wave. Ben was just saying it several different ways. Email us at podcast@engadget.com. Leave us a review on iTunes and subscribe on anything that gets podcasts. If we ended up on your, you know, wrap-ups, let us know. Always love to hear that people are enjoying the show. Thanks, folks. We're out.